This is the Body Sphere. Let's go for a walk.
I love to go wandering along the mountain track. And as I go, I love to sing my knapsack on my back. Marie,
Amanda Smith with you Marie, here on RN.
Now then, what was it again?
Also, I have a silly walk, and I'd like to obtain a government grant to help me develop it.
I see. May I see your silly walk?
Yes, certainly, yes.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's it, is it?
Yes, that's it, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not particularly silly, is it? I mean, the right leg isn't silly at all, and the left leg merely does a forward aerial half turn every alternate step.
Yes, but I think with government backing, I could make it very silly.
From silly walks to historic walks, it's all about putting one foot in front of the other. And this episode of The Body Sphere is about walking in all its ordinary wonder. Baby's first steps, do you remember? A pair of competitive race walkers, it might look funny, but boy, do they go. And the endurance walking of a pilgrim, all putting one foot in front of the other.
Where does it start? Muscles tense, one leg a pillar, holding the body upright between the earth and sky. The other a pendulum, swinging from behind. Heel touches down. The whole weight of the body rolls forward onto the ball of the foot. The big toe pushes off, and the delicately balanced weight of the body shifts again. The legs reverse position. It starts with a step, and then another step, and then another, that add up like taps on a drum to a rhythm, the rhythm of walking. The most obvious and the most obscure thing in the world, this walking, that wanders so readily into religion, philosophy, landscape, urban policy, anatomy, allegory, and heartbreak.
That's from a book by Rebecca Solnit called Wanderlust, A History of Walking, published back in 2001. Someone else who's a writer and a walker, who writes about walking, is Ailsa Piper.
My favourite type of walking is actually incredibly slow. I use it in workshops when I'm teaching writing, concentrating on the action of heel, ball, toe, which most of us don't even think about. We just slam into the day and walk. But in fact, the minute you bring your attention to the act of walking in a very specific way, walking becomes difficult. So it's this interesting balance between a thing that we do without thinking, and the thing that is, for me, the most important motif of being alive. You know, all those road metaphors and the idea of walking through your days and all those things we take for granted, but in fact, it's at the centre of who we are. I mean, if you think about it, you can tell anybody from their walk. Anyone you know, you see from the back, you know instantly who it is by the way that their hips move or their foot hits the ground. It's beautiful and individual as a thumbprint, I suspect.
Well, some forms of physical activity require full concentration on the activity itself, so like playing sport, whereas, say, something like yoga is designed to be an activity that stills the mind. So do you walk? Are you walking to think about walking, to silence your mind, or to allow for thoughts and ideas?
Mostly I walk to silence my mind, but of course what happens is the best ideas then come in that space. So it's a contradictory thing, and you can't make one or the other happen. But I am a firm believer in the rhythm of walking. And for instance, the difference between, you know, a 1 hour power walk, which I do, and a 6 or 7 or 8 hour glorious kind of long stretching walk, you know, between Daylesford and Castlemaine in Victoria or something like that, where it's like you're in this space that is about enlargement, not part, well, both enlargement and also kind of becoming miniature. There's a very strange thing when you're on a long walk where you sense yourself as very small, and I feel a great relief in that. It's like you get to see yourself as part of the wider world. And within that, things go very quiet for me, and it's about that rhythm. And the rhythm of that walking, because you know you're going to do it for 6 or 8 hours, is a quite different rhythm to the rhythm of exercise walking. And I don't think thoughts come or thoughts still for me in exercise walking, but they do in that extended person in nature walking.
So is that rambling? Is that strolling? Is it meandering? Or is it walking with purpose?
I think sometimes it's a bit of each, but that depends on the terrain too, because the terrain sometimes says, pull your focus into me. I'm going to demand that as you cross this, you know, bridge, or you walk up this shaly slope, or worse, walking down a shaly slope, you know, you've got to bring your focus in, and suddenly you become aware of yourself in relation to the earth. But then there are other times, and sometimes I've had it happen for hours, where you have that strange, and I suppose it's what meditators talk about, the deep, very precise awareness of where you are, coupled with an absolute sense of time and space being irrelevant. And that only happens to me on long walks, but it happens an awful lot. It happens pretty much every day if you've got several days of long walking.
Ailsa, do you walk on a treadmill?
I have, and I can, but I find it just hilarious. I can't do gyms. I was a real gym bunny, I don't know, back in the 80s, Madonna. But I just find exercising inside now is not for me. And walking on a treadmill just seems to me to be only related to exercise and not to anything that is what I love about walking, which is the sort of organic nature of it, that every step is made in relationship to a changing surface or the sound of your feet and all those things. And I get why people have to do it, but it really doesn't float my boat.
Well, now you've walked and you've written about walking the pilgrim routes in Spain. Is walking roads of pilgrimage different from walking other paths, other treks? You've done all sorts of other long walks around this country and others.
Mm. It is, in the sense, I suppose, that, you know, you go in and out of relationship with people who are walking with real intent. The walks I do that I would call hikes, and a lot of them are around Australia. I love the Great Dividing Trail. I loved walking the Larapinta and the Overland in Tasmania. There's a difference there. There's a real kind of sense of I'm going at nature, you know, I'm going at it, for me anyway, and I'm going to kind of learn about nature, and I'm going to be in nature, and it's nature. But the pilgrimage routes demand of you a kind of submission. They have called people literally from all around the world for thousands of years, and so, in fact, my appropriate place there is to walk those roads. It's quite appropriate for me to do it. I'm always filled with a sense of, you know, that thing that they say about walking lightly on the earth in Australia, because I'm not sure that it's always appropriate for me to be where I'm walking. And, you know, I don't get stifled by that, but I think there is a thing that you're doing what you're meant to be doing on a pilgrimage road. And there's all those thousands of years of other walkers with their desires and yearnings and hopes and longings in their feet. I mean, they talk there about praying with your feet. That's what they call it.
There's also the thing that the Camino has been described as taking your life for a walk.
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. I think even if people only end up walking 100 or 200 kilometres, that happens. But certainly the first one I walked was the well-known one, which was about 780 kilometres, the Camino Francés, and then 1,300 kilometres. When you walk for that long, it's impossible to escape yourself. And particularly the second walk, which is a very solitary one, I only saw one other walker for 400 kilometres. You're thrown back on yourself and your preparedness, I think, to be humble, because walking is a humble act. Anyone can walk. Well, no, please let me never lose the ability to walk, but we're all mostly born with the ability to walk. And, you know, the notion of the first step is such a profound thing for a parent with a child. And so I think that sense of just you and the road and the notion that you will get to a place changed, that's really what's at the heart of the pilgrimage experience. You will be changed by walking.
Ailsa Piper is the author of Sinning Across Spain, A Walker's Journey from Granada to Galicia. You're listening to The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith, taking you on a meandering stroll from long walks to baby steps, the very first ones.
Keep standing, keep trying to stand. Okay, now I want you to let go of my hand, because you don't need my hand. That's very good standing. Okay, let's take one step. One step. One step. Second step, third step, fourth step. Oh! You did some very good walking there, sweetheart.
Thank you.
You took four steps on your own.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's try that again. One, one, two, three. You just did four steps. It's a good girl. Walk towards mummy. Walk towards mummy. Keep going.
Keep going.
Hop up, that's it.
Ah, baby Lucia taking her very first steps with her mum Erica at that wondrous moment. It's human nature that pretty much whatever we can do physically, running, jumping, walking, we turn into a sport. Chris Erickson and Regan Lamble are competitive race walkers. Both have represented Australia at Olympic Games. Race walkers, with that very distinctive gait, compete over distances of 20Ks and 50Ks, so more or less half marathon and marathon distances. But why walk when you can run, even on a lovely warm morning by the river? What impels anyone to become a race walker?
I actually got into race walking through my father. So I'm one of four boys and we all grew up watching him compete. He went to two Commonwealth Games in 1978 and 82, so we were always around the sport.
So really, you had no choice?
Yes, true. Yeah, I've got a fairly good excuse.
Initially, I actually didn't like the sport or the event at all. I sort of always avoided it.
Because?
And then, just particularly for a little kid, you know, it's not as exciting as the other events and I never really took it seriously.
Well, I guess I've tried over the years most sports, at least had a little go, but not race walking. I don't know anything about it at all. Can you describe the technique that's involved? Because it's quite different from ordinary walking, isn't it?
It is actually. It's quite different to normal walking. When you sort of tell someone you're a race walker, you get some pretty interesting comments.
Such as?
I guess some people just think it is just essentially pedestrian walking. So sometimes people say, oh, you know, how do you even train for race walking when it's just, you know, I could go to the Olympics for that. It is obviously essentially walking, but there's a lot of technical rules. Fundamentally, the biggest thing is you have to have one foot on the ground at all times or one foot in contact with the ground. So essentially you're not running.
And then the second rule is the knee rule. So when your front heel hits the ground, your knee is meant to be locked and straight. So that's what can give it the funny technique, if you like, because you've got a straight knee, it sends your hip out. So you get that, what we call the hip wobble, if you like.
Now, you mentioned the supporting leg straightens as the weight goes onto it and the hip movement. Is it hard on your hips, race walking? It looks it.
While it does look hard on the hips, I think when you've got a fluent action and you can do the technique properly, it's actually not that bad. And one of the saving things in it is that it's low impact. So because you're sort of rolling through, you're not hitting the ground as hard as you are when you're running. While it can look quite daunting on the hips, as I said, when you've got the right technique, it's not bad.
Chris, do you have to train yourself not to break into a run when you're race walking? Because, you know, a run is, after all, a more natural way to move quickly.
I do have a lot of people say to me, oh, don't you just want to run to go faster? And you know, I sort of say, well, no, not really, because I'm out here to walk. And I compare it to breaststroke in swimming. I mean, it's obviously faster to go freestyle, but you're a breaststroker, so the aim is to go as fast as you possibly can breaststroking and using the breaststroke technique. Walking is similar in that. You're trying to go as fast as you possibly can, but within the rules of the sport.
There's a fine line, I suppose, between walking and running. when you do start to move at those high speeds.
Have you been disqualified, Regan, from a big race?
I'm pretty fortunate that I haven't been. I've come close a few times. So essentially you get three warnings in a race, or three reports, and if you get three, then you're disqualified. It's quite common for walkers to sit on two reports during a race.
And how do you feel when you're sitting on those two reports?
That can be what does make the sport a little bit more interesting is, you know, you can get to sort of the pointy end of a race and sitting on two reports, so then you could sort of take off and try and get an edge on them, but then obviously you're jeopardising your chance at actually finishing the race. And it's quite difficult when you're fatigued as well to sort of maintain good technique towards the end of a race.
Well, and the most famous disqualification I remember is Jane Saville, the Australian race walker at the Sydney Olympics in 2000, which was so disappointing for the home crowd cheering her on, well, not to mention for her as well. And Chris, have you ever been disqualified from a big race?
My one and only ever disqualification came in the 2008 Olympics. So I'd managed to get myself all the way to the top part of the sport. And on that day in Beijing, I didn't think that I walked any different on that day, but unfortunately I was disqualified there. But, you know, since then I've made another Olympics, and that was a big thing for my next 4 years, was to get to another Olympics and make sure I got a result on the board. And obviously I did that in London. Yeah, and with Jane having been, a lot of people, when you say to them, oh, I'm a walker, a lot of the first things they'll say to you is, oh, what was that girl in the Sydney Olympics who got disqualified? But the way she held herself over that day, I think, God, she could have gone and just spat the dummy, but she held herself really, really well in that and came back 4 years later. So I took a lot out of that as well. She gave me a lot of advice what to do over the next few years to recover from that.
So you didn't spit the dummy?
No, but I was sitting in the bowels of the stadium bawling my eyes out at the end of it, and I had to go sit in the back corner, and, you know, it took a little while to recover from it, but used that as a big motivating factor for the following 4 years.
Do you ever, Regan, get ribbed for doing this walk? Which, to the uninitiated, you have to say does look a bit funny. I mean, it is, after all, the chosen sport of Kel Knight from Kath and Kim.
It is a very funny sport, and to be honest, I think if I didn't walk, if I saw people walking, I'd probably just think it was hilarious. So I can certainly understand why it does have that sort of stigma associated with it. So many people just pay it out all the time, which is fine. People can laugh at it, but as long as they sort of appreciate it. It's when you get people who are like, oh, you know, do you even have to train for that? I think they just don't realise how much sort of effort you have to put in, despite it being walking.
You develop a thick skin pretty quickly, and, you know, I've got a few quick replies in my basket when someone might yell out a bit of abuse at me. I can quickly turn around and give it back to them.
Give me an example.
You know, there might be the occasional runner or something might give you a bit of a blast. A lot of times I'm actually going faster than they are, and I might just give them a bit of why don't you try and keep up for a kilometre or so, and they try, and then they'll go out the back door pretty quickly. One of the really nice feelings when you are out training and you pass a runner, it's actually quite a great feeling. And you will get that comment, oh, geez, that person's going faster than I can run.
Chris Erickson and Regan Lamble, both of them training to race walk at the next Summer Olympic Games in Rio. On air and online at RN, Amanda Smith with you. This is The Body Sphere, talking about walking. In the non-competitive, long-distance environment, such as the Camino walks across Spain that Ailsa Piper has done, on a practical level, Ailsa, do you use walking poles?
I love them. I love them for any walk longer than a couple of hours. For what they give me in terms of support, particularly on the downhill, I don't need help uphill. I love to climb. I hate coming down. And for anyone with knee issues or anything like that, they are just the best. But also, I often walk for hours with them strung across my shoulders, kind of in the manner of carrying a cross, I suppose. When I've done that for a few days, my shoulders, my entire upper body has changed from that expansive sort of opening thing. I twirl them like a cheerleader. They're like a companion as much as a physical sort of assistance. The other thing is, you know, blood flows to the hands if you walk a long day without the poles, and you get very fat fingers. They can be quite painful after 8 hours of hands being down. The poles do that wonderful thing of keeping the upper body oxygenated, and they're brilliant.
Well, as you've talked about, you do take very long walks. As you said, the Granada to Galicia walk is 1,300 k's. You did it in 43 days. That's pretty serious, focused walking. And for all that it sounds wonderful, in reality, there must have been an awful lot of discomfort and blood and sweat and tears.
Yeah, and I think it's probably like what they say about childbirth, that you remember the good stuff. Yes, there is. I suppose the thing I always say about that is it's a choice. At any point, you can stop and hail a cab. And so there's something about the will that's in your legs to keep going. But, yeah, there are days, whether it's a hike in Australia or a walk there, where the terrain really says to you, who are you? And the weather says, who are you? What are you made of?
What have you got?
Yeah. And we'll throw everything at you, and now we'll throw some more. Oh, you know, I go back to that thing of humility. It's like the road can bring you to your knees so fast, and it did on many occasions and has with me. But the other thing about it is, just when you think you know your limits, you can be surprised. And it's that simple, simple thing of listening to the body, because we're so in our head. I mean, I have this real belief that we preface the mind a bit too much, because the body remembers so much that I believe the cells of the body remember everything. And so if you crawl, in my experience of writing workshops, if you get people crawling or skipping, they'll suddenly write from their childhood. And if you go into the different rhythms of walking, all manner of memories come up. And so there's something, I think, about what the body holds that is particularly important and that people forget. And that's why the long walk is so extraordinary, because we get taken through all sorts of stages of different rhythms which relate to different stages of our life too. I did nothing but plod. It was wet, it was cold. My boots were soaked through, and the path was dotted with dung of infinitely varied perfume and texture. I felt like excrement myself. One stream had swollen to a river. The path led straight to the water's edge and took up again about 20 metres away on the other side. No bridge was visible. No people either. Cold had frozen me from my saturated boots right up to my brain, and the only solution I could imagine was to strip off and wade across. The rain stopped, so I clenched my teeth, peeled off damp trousers and knickers, and stuffed them into the outer pockets of my pack. I tied my sock-filled boots in place around it, tucked my T-shirt up into my bra, hoisted pack and walking poles over my head, and walked towards the shallows, singing Waltzing Matilda as loudly as I could.
Why Waltzing Matilda?
I don't know. I think about that now, and it's like you had all these gorgeous songs you could have sung. You know, you could have chosen anything, and what came out was Waltzing Matilda. There is that thing, of course, that Matilda is the swag, and he was a swag man, and that's the other thing I have about any kind of walking with a pack, is that there is a sense of tradition, you know, not just the mystical walkers who walked, but also that memory of, you know, the Depression and the people who...
Sundowners.
Yes, who would just walk and hope. And I often thought about them... I'm surprised I did at that point, but I often thought about them when people would come racing out of places and offer me food. Again, there's that thing about if you're on foot, you're not a threat generally to people, even with your walking poles. You know, no one looks at you and thinks robber or anything like that, because you've got a pack on, you couldn't get away fast, you probably look bedraggled and filthy. And so it evokes a kind of kindness in people, I think.
Mm. It is a sort of anti-luxury holiday, isn't it? I mean, I wonder if, as walking has been replaced, you know, for us with ever more efficient, faster forms of transportation, it's walking is a way for, you know, urbanised, industrialised people to feel a little bit free.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I mean, I think also the freedom comes from discovering that the body is this marvellously reliable thing on the whole. I mean, yes, there are aches and pains and all of that, but there's a real freedom in thinking, wow, I can get myself through this. I mean, even walking in cities, a lot of the Spanish walking is through the outskirts of a city.
Yes, but, it's not pretty.
No. I mean, you know, if you imagine walking in from, I don't know, from Tullamarine Airport in Melbourne to the centre of town or from Perth Airport along the freeway, it's never going to be pretty. But even there, there's a real sense of almost... almost disdain for the people in cars. It's like, yeah, it's easy for you, but look at me. So there is a real kind of boost to the self-esteem or something that comes when the body's moving and you're walking and in control of that beautiful thing of heel, ball, toe.
Well, towards the end of that long 1300K walk in Spain, you write this phrase, Elsa, the euphoria of the well-oiled body. Do you want to just elaborate on that?
Yeah, that phrase comes at a point where there suddenly were a lot of new walkers on the Camino path. We were getting close to the destination. And the thing with the Camino roads is that if you walk 100 kilometres, you get this certificate that says you've walked a pilgrimage. So those of us who start walking 1,300 kilometres back, you suffer all your physical aches and pains because no matter how good a walker you are, there's the adjustment period to walking every day. And you do all that and you go through the blisters or the aches or the pack aches or whatever. And then there's a point, which is different for everyone, that kicks in where you actually are a walker. That's all you are. You're just this walker. And that is, oh, it's relief, but it's also this incredibly easy kind of connected way of being in the environment, you know. And nothing seems impossible at that point when the body kicks in like that. And at that point, I remember seeing the people who had just started and seeing them wrestling with blisters and with not being able to get their pack to sit in the right place and with how much water should they carry and, you know, with the multitude of aches and pains that are bodies that don't normally do anything much physically wanting to make this journey. It was a nice thing to be brought back to the awareness of that because, in fact, you take for granted that moment when actually you can just do this thing. You can do it and you can fly in a way because it becomes like flying, you know. So, yeah, the well-oiled body, I mean, probably not smelling very nice, but, boy, it felt good.
Elsa Piper. Details for her book Sinning Across Spain are on the Bodysphere website at abc.net.au/rn. Would love to hear your walking stories too. Have you ever felt the euphoria of the well-oiled body? There's something to aim for. I'm Amanda Smith, just taking it one step at a time.
Keep going.